Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 393 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 14th of September, 2018, as I record this. So today I'm talking about travel writing 2.0 with Tim Leffel, who has over 20 years experience as a travel writer working all over the world. And Tim has some really great tips on how to make money as a travel writer in the new media landscape where everyone is an Instagram photographer and ideas on how to build intellectual property that will make you money for the long term, as well as getting cash as a freelancer right now. Plus some tips on living in other countries if you want a better life for half the price. So that is coming up. And of course, I always love talking about travel. And part of me is a travel writer because all my novels include stuff about my travels. And I'm really starting to put together my plans on how I'm going to expand JF Pen. And my travel photography is definitely going to be part of that on jfpen.com. So more on that when I, more on that once it's started. So in publishing news this week, and this first story is really for awareness only, as I'm not really sure what to think about it myself as yet. I've tried to read some things and still not quite sure. But the European Parliament has voted in favour of the EU Copyright Directive, which is a controversial piece of legislation aimed at updating copyright for the internet age. Now, there's a lot of discussion about this going on in the sort of creative community and copyright community, intellectual property stuff. The Society of Authors in the UK are for it, but internet freedom activist Cory Doctorow from Boing Boing, and obviously an author in his own right, is against it. And to me, I guess more telling is that Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia is against it, and also Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web. And I definitely can't say I understand a lot of the the copyright and internet stuff that is going on. And there is scaremongering and hyperbole on both sides, but it is complicated. And I think the most important thing with all this stuff is that you are aware of it and the potential ramifications. This has the potential to make online platforms like Google and Facebook directly liable for content uploaded by users. And, you know, we'll put in place ways of stopping infringement of copyright. But some people think that the problem will be that it will stop a lot of original work being uploaded, and that these filters will be too strong in places. It also gives news publishers a right to restrict how their stories are featured on news aggregators such as Google News. So there's definitely, and there's talk of licenses. So they are trying to look at ways to, I guess, think about how online content sharing works in a new world. I think it's clear that we do need some changes in the way these things work. And I really just hope that the people doing this know what they're talking about. But why I wanted to mention this is because, as ever, there are things flying around on Facebook and Twitter that are sort of turning into heated debate without backup to sources. So no more fake news, please. Please don't share things unless you have read about this. So I'll link to some of the pieces in the show notes, but certainly Publishing Perspectives has an article, Ars Technica and The Verge are sites that I have been reading about that. So on my personal update this week, you might be able to hear it in my voice, but I am in the post-massive edit book launch. Sorry, not even book launch. My brain is all over the place. Seriously, I'm in this slump that happens after you kind of finish a project, any project. And it's not that I've even finished, but I got the quite decent edit done on Valley of Dry Bones and sent that off to my editor at the beginning of this week. And then I kind of just, and we also had, we've had family here for 3 weeks and they just left. And the seasons are changing here, definitely autumn now. It's chillier in at night and in the morning. And I posted on Instagram a picture of my conker, my first conker of the season, which is a horse chestnut, to those Americans. And so I'm definitely feeling quite tired but happy. I mean, I'm happy about finishing the book. I'm pleased with it, but as always, Jen, my editor, is also my first reader. So I'm looking forward to her feedback. And then I will be sending the book out to beta readers, a proofreader, and I'm starting to plan my book launch stuff. So yeah, lots going on. But when you go from a period of quite intense writing work to then the finishing energy of, okay, now I need to finish all the bits and bobs that have to happen to put the book into the world. it becomes, I find it the downward swing of the circle. But remember, these things are a circle. And so to offset that, I have also been reading stuff on maps to start getting myself back into the map walker world. And so starting on the upswing of the next book, which is always fun. And I have set up the pre-orders. So if you're interested, you can go and have a look. And if you'd like to know what it's about, I'm now going to read you the blurb because it's my show and I can. So, Valley of Dry Bones, an ancient prophecy, an occult secret, the power to raise the dead. When a long hidden tomb and a body covered in voodoo symbols are found in New Orleans, arcane agent Jake Timber discovers a mystery that stretches back to the Spanish Empire and the bloody dungeons of the Inquisition. But he is not the only one who seeks the hand of Ezekiel. A shadowy billionaire, backed by those who seek immortality at any price, will stop at nothing to find the relics that can turn bones to living flesh. When disaster strikes in the heart of the Louisiana Bayou, Jake calls on arcane agent Morgan Sierra to help him once more as they race against time across the outposts of the Spanish Empire. From Madrid and Toledo to the Philippines, Peru, and on to New Orleans and San Francisco, can Morgan and Jake find the relics and stop the resurrection of the dead? A page-turning archaeological thriller with elements of the supernatural and occult, Valley of Dry Bones blends religious mystery with Indiana Jones-style action-adventure. So there you go. There's my dramatic reading of Valley of Dry Bones. And I'm still getting comments from you guys about whether or not I should narrate my own fiction. And what I am definitely going to do short stories. And in fact, I'm now standing and Dan, my wonderful audio guy, has been helping me set up the cupboard, the walk-in cupboard, with better audio soundproofing and stuff like that. So we're going through that. I'm also looking at voice coaching. So those of you who think I was just going to do it without any help, don't you worry. But certainly Valley of Dry Bones will be narrated by my normal narrator, Veronica Jaguer. So looking forward to that. Okay, so yes, Valley of Dry Bones. Also, this week I passed my 7 years as an author entrepreneur, and every year on my freedom anniversary, that's what I like to call it, I post an article about my lessons learned. So I'm going to link to this in the show notes because it's much better in writing. But just to let you know a few of my lessons learned, I guess I've talked a bit about some of these things on the show. But the first one is, what's your zone of genius? Say no to good in order to say yes to great. And I mentioned the Gay Hendricks book, The Big Leap. In a previous show, and the four zones, where the zone of genius is the things that we're good at or want to be, the things we enjoy and our unique ability, the things that fulfill the reason we were put on this earth. And yet so many of us spend time in our zone of competence, things we're good at but don't really enjoy. And I think many, or even zone of excellence, things we're good at and sometimes enjoy but are not necessarily fulfilling our life purpose. So very much I'm focusing more on my zone of genius and creating more of my own fiction in the world. And that's why I kind of want to do audiobooks too, which I'll come back to in a minute. Secondly, building multiple author brands is hard work. Focus on building your body of work for the long term, preferably with one or two author brands and not more. And of course, I reflect on giving up Penny Appleton with my mum, which I've talked about, and also refer to Chris Rush's book on creating your author brand. And of course, Chris was on the show a couple of weeks ago. And then looking at content marketing. So I've put here, content marketing rocks for long-term sustainable income. Time to try it seriously for fiction. And reflecting on sort of the 10 years I've built the Creative Pen off the back of content marketing and how I am now looking at doing that for fiction. And also really reflecting on paid ads versus content marketing and saying, creating content is inherently rewarding for me, as well as useful and inspirational for others. It's not just marketing. It's also something new in the world that stands alone. I can't say the same for paid ads. And I really feel that, like, you know, I feel that this show is part of my body of work and not just, in quotation marks, marketing. And of course, you guys hopefully find it helpful. So it's good for many things. And certainly with paid ads, I feel like it doesn't warrant my time. I mean, yes, it works to sell books, but I only have a limited time on this earth. And, you know, half the time I don't want to spend doing that. So anyway, I am really looking into content marketing for fiction, and I will be talking about that after Nink. And then finally, personal branding will only become more important as AI, algorithms and big data become more prominent. And I'm currently listening to you as an audiobook, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari. And it's actually quite a scary book. I'm finding it, as someone who is like inherently positive, I'm finding it a little difficult. But I really think he's one of the great thinkers of our time. And so I read everything he puts out, and it helps me consider the bigger picture. His previous book, Sapiens and Homo Deus, are pretty incredible. And so, yeah, this is a really interesting book with a lot of updated stuff about infotech and biotech, including AI. And as I write in my my notes here, AIs already write music. They create portraits sold as art at Christie's. They win chess matches. They write nonfiction journalism. They write novels that almost win awards. And I've hyperlinked to all the evidence for all of that. And we're only at the beginning of what they will be able to do. And so, yeah, really just talking about how I'm fully intending to use AI tools to help me create, but also the way to stand out is to connect with people in a personal way as a personal brand. And that's why I want to do more voice work, because you guys know, because you're listening to my voice is incredibly personal. And I think that this is the way I'm going to help with my fiction, is also by connecting with voice. So yeah, and you can always find my timeline posts, I call them, because they're sort of big markers in my career as an author entrepreneur. I've collected all of those on thecreativepen.com/timeline. And so you can go back and see the posts that I've been writing over the years. Particularly if you're just starting out, you might find my first year, this is year 7, but my year 1 lessons learned are really interesting. And I still look back at those and go, goodness me, how did I get through? That first year is difficult. So if you're struggling, go back and check thecreativepen.com/timeline, and you might see that I was struggling as much as you are. So yeah, hopefully that'll make you feel better. Okay. Okay, and finally, useful stuff. Book launch timelines. This is a very, very good timing for me because I'm coming into book launch. Whether you are launching, relaunching, or you just want some tips for next time, I'm doing a webinar with Tim Grawl, who was on the show last week, obviously. And Tim is a book launch specialist, launches a lot of authors into the bestseller list. We are doing a webinar on book launch timelines, including the four types of book launches, when to start your launch, the book launch timeline checklist, and of course I have just to add here, I have started my checklist finally after Tim kicked my butt last week. I have actually started a checklist now because I'm going through this right now. I thought right now is the time to get my checklist done. So that is something I'm doing. So you can sign up for the webinar at booklaunch.com/penn. It is on Thursday, 20th of September at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. And if you register, you can get the replay. And hopefully that link will point to something useful in the future too. So booklaunch.com/penn for our book launch webinar. Right, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and photos this week. I'm really happy that I got loads of photos. I do love seeing photos, which I think is why I'm enjoying Instagram so much right now. But basically, yes, thank you. Please keep sending me photos of what you're doing while you are listening to the show. Even if it's boring to you, I will find it interesting. And also let me know where you are in the world when you're listening. I have included some of your tweets in the presentation for NINC, Novelists Inc., to demonstrate that content marketing is truly global and you can put something on the internet and people will find it all over the world. But just a few comments and tweets for this week. Marion says, thanks for bringing on Kinga from Publish Drive. Thanks for showing us the way how indies should publish widely and globally. It has broadened my outlook, and markets outside of the US and UK will play a bigger role in my indie author character. I would like to get some tips on how to sell in France and Germany. I will actually be talking to Camille from Kobe Writing Life in a couple of weeks' time. So we will definitely talk about France and Germany because she is French. So that will be fun. So Guy Windsor sent a picture crossing the Magyar plain in Hungary on the way home from a swordsmanship event I was teaching at, listening to the show on the train. And of course, Guy was on the show a couple of years ago now talking about sword fighting and fantastic. Always love to see pictures of swords from Guy or anyone else. If you're a sword fighter, send me a picture of your sword. And that was not an innuendo. Amy Maroney says, just listened to your podcast while exploring historical Vermont and snapped a photo of a graveyard just for you. Thank you, Amy. And I do love the number of pictures of graveyards I get from all over the world. Seriously, I really love it. It makes me feel very happy. And it reminds me of how short our life is and how we just have to get on with stuff and create what we want to create. Monica T. Rodriguez says, I'm taking my sister's dog for a long walk, listening to the show, making sure to stop and smell the flowers, and sent me a lovely picture of flowers. I do love flowers. Thank you, Monica. A couple more. Casey Beth sent a picture of her writing barn looking out on the olive orchard, which was beautiful, and said Tim Grohl's practical advice and real honesty are encouraging, as she's editing right now. Benjamin Douglas sent pictures of boiling apples for homemade cider while listening to the interview with Tim. Sent really nice pictures of apples. See, look, people do such interesting things while they're listening to the show. And Kelsey Stelting sent a lovely picture of her smiley face on her lunch break. And Kelsey, you definitely made me smile. It's a very human thing, isn't it? You see a smile, you have to smile back. And finally, Radek Pazdera says, listening to the show on my break between editing at the British Library. And of course, the British Library, if you do come to London at any point, the British Library is on your must visit list because they have this treasures gallery, which is just incredible. Thank you, Radek. And thanks to everyone who sent emails and tweets and comments and everything. So tweet me at the Creative Pen, pen with a double N, as you all know by now, obviously. Right, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I will play a word from them in a minute. Thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. I have a bumper crop this week, so thank you to all the new patrons, Annette Drake, Margaret, Anne Thors, Julia Gandrud, Meet Writing in the Fast Lane, Marla Naidu, Rashida Costa, John Howard, Iona Findlay, Kimberly Deed, or Deed, I think it's Deed, Kimberly Deed, Chaos Flair, which is a super name, Harper Bliss, Donna R. Ferrin, Dr. Joe Eckler, and Jesse Quack. Thank you so much to everyone supporting the show. It does mean so much to me, and I really appreciate your support on Patreon. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording this week before I head off to Florida. So check out supporting the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobo Writing Life, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen listeners, I'm Chrissy, the director of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free self-publishing platform created by writers for writers.
And I'm Stephanie, and I work on our publisher operations team for KWO. And together, we are the Kobo Writing Life podcast. Do you want to get your books into hands of readers all over the world?
Do you want to work with a company and self-publishing team that care about you and want to help you succeed?
Anytime you need help, a real person from our team will get back to you within 2 days.
If you have feedback, we use it to make KWL even better. Just recently, we added sales report and payment history right in the dashboard under my account to make tracking those details even easier.
And we're currently in the process of revamping the dashboard with analytics based on comments from authors like you.
Yeah, your fingerprints are all over this thing.
So for more tips and tricks for self-publishing, check out the Kobo Writing Life podcast.
We are Kobo Writing Life. We want to help you achieve your dreams.
Visit us today at kobo.com/writinglife.
Today, I'm here with Tim Leffel. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on the show. Just a little introduction. Tim is the author of travel books, including A Better Life for Half the Price and Travel Writing 2.0, Earning Money from Your Travels in the New Media Landscape. He's also an award-winning travel writer for sites like Lonely Planet and the editor at PerceptiveTravel.com and CheapestDestinationsBlog.com. Tim does loads of things. So tell us a bit more about you and how you got into travel writing.
Well, I could give you a really long story about how all this started, but I'll keep it kind of short. I used to work in the music business, first in Nashville and then in New York City as a marketing guy. And so I was doing a lot of writing, corporate writing, kind of band bios and that kind of thing. And I met the girl of my dreams and we started dating, and she said, "I want to go traveling around the world, and I'm going to go whether you go or not, but I would like you to go with me." And so it was the dilemma where I had a car and a condo and this career track and everything. But then we kind of both got this sign from above or wherever the stars aligned, where I hated my boss and I got fired and her company went out of business. And so it was kind of like, oh, I guess this is the time to go then. So we saved a little more money and then we took off, and I was just looking for something to do along the way that would bring in a little income. And I thought, well, I've already done all this writing before. So I just started sending queries to editors and got a few things published back in the day when that was the only way to get published, was, you know, to send queries to editors. And I got a few trade jobs like reviewing hotels, and one thing led to another. But I stayed part time for a really long time. When we stopped traveling after 3 years and teaching English and other things, I got an office job again, but I kept writing on the side. And then when the blogging world came along, that's when I really started to take this seriously and realize I could make a full-time income at it without killing myself. So I became a full-time travel writer about 12, 13 years ago.
Wow. And I mean, that really was, I guess, the first when blogging really started to become more serious and people started to make some money with blogs, which is amazing. But you've seen this landscape really shift. So and some people I talk to, some people who want to be travel writers, and they seem to be fixed in the way it used to be years ago, you know, like getting Condé Nast Traveler or something. So how has the landscape changed for freelance travel writers? How is it, and does it reflect the shift in publishing in general, I guess?
Yeah, I only know three full-time travel writers personally who are making a good living at it just doing freelance. It still can be done, but it's a real hustle. You know, you got to be out there sending pitches every day. And, you know, a lot of times they're juggling three or four deadlines at once. And, it's just you got to put a lot more jobs together because there just aren't as many publications out there as there used to be, and they're thinner than they used to be. They don't have as much content. And so it's tougher to get those, you know, $2 a word assignments and string a bunch of them together in a month like you could in the good old days. I don't think those were really the good old days either, but it can be done, but I think it's a lot easier to have multiple streams of income. And online, you can do that in many more ways. And of course, book publishing, which you talk about all the time. There are a lot more ways now to sort of take control of your destiny rather than getting permission from someone else to publish what you write.
Mm. So let's go into some of those multiple streams of income, because I do actually know some travel writers, and they are doing what you say, like the gig economy. And it does seem as if there are so many people, and, you know, they say, oh, you know, some people will do this for free. Like, people will write articles for free because they get to go to places, and or maybe they'll even pay their own costs. So let's look at it from the other perspective. What are some of the multiple streams of income that you have or that other travel writers have?
Yeah, the ones I know that are really successful, that are, you know, making six figures at this, have 8, 10, 12 different income streams. It's pretty common. So I don't think that's an unusual thing anymore. But yeah, I mean, if you have a blog or you have some kind of, you know, website that you publish, there's, of course, many ways to monetize that, from AdSense to network ads to direct deals to sponsorships and sponsored posts and those kinds of things. You can make money from affiliate ads where you link to a product, and if somebody buys it, you know, you get a commission, and that can work for hotels or HomeAway or whatever. And then a lot of people sell their own products, whether those are books or ebooks or tour services or itinerary planning. You know, if you're an expert in a certain area, you can sort of parlay that expertise into other things. And people get paid for speaking. You know, once you become an expert at something, it's, you know this from your own experience, it's easy to sort of branch off into other areas using that expertise.
Yeah.
Publishing too. Mm. No, just for me, that's books are probably 10 or 15% of my income. So it's a decent amount.
Yeah, that is actually, and I mean, we're gonna come back to your books because they're really awesome. And in fact, the travel writing 2.0 is, you know, where we're really talking about at the moment, the different things you talk about in that book. But then I wanted to ask you there about that, like you said, books are sort of 10-15%. I've seen, you know, looking at your blogs, you do have ads on the blogs. Would you say at this point, because I really feel that affiliate income can be stronger than ads or AdSense, you know, pay-per-click ads on a blog, if you're getting in a niche. Are you, and I've never had ads on my blog in that way, but have you found that affiliates stuff can work better when you're doing targeted articles, for example, over advertising?
Yeah, it can work well if you're doing a very targeted post, or your blog in general is very targeted. And when I started out, which was very long time ago, 2003 is when I launched my first blog. There wasn't even any ads since then. I don't think, we mostly just had affiliate ads for Amazon, I remember. And then other companies started jumping on. The problem with travel, though, is people are kind of set in their ways as far as where they book their trips. You know, they're used to using Expedia or Kayak or Trivago or whatever they use, and they've got it on their phone a lot of times. So you're not necessarily going to get that last click for them to book, but it can work for sure. And some people do better at it than others. Again, the more general your topic is, the harder it is to earn money from affiliate links, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Okay, so let's, you had a very interesting post, which I thought was great, around the myths of travel writing, which I think are huge. So can you talk about some of the most common myths that people have about travel writing?
Yeah, and some of those are perpetuated by these people who sell courses. You know, they're selling the dream and showing people on a beach with their laptop drinking a cocktail, and it all looks so glamorous and easy. But of course, you know, we do have trips like that sometimes, but most of the time we're holed up in an office just like any other writer trying to bang it out, you know, and so it's not all that glamorous when it comes to the actual work. But it looks fun because it is. It's travel, you know, so of course that's more fun than writing about colonoscopies or something. So it does attract people. But it takes a while to get there. That's the whole thing that I think is not ever discussed. I mean, if you start a blog today, it's going to take you 2 or 3 years before you're making real money from it. And that's if you do everything right. I've seen people, you know, move that up a little bit, make it a bit faster, even a year. But it's really tough to make it happen faster than that. And the same with freelancing. You're not going to start out writing for Condé Nast Traveler at $2 a word. You're going to start getting, you know, $50 from somebody, or you're going to get $15 a blog post to write things. So, you know, it's not a quick and easy way to make money. It's a fun way to make money, but it's not a quick and easy way to make money. So anyone who dives into this shouldn't expect to take off on a round the world trip and be earning the big bucks before their trip is over.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's probably true of most writing careers. It takes years to kind of get it going. So if people are starting out now, like if they're, because we, you know, all of this is possible if you do take the time and you focus on things. So if people are starting out now, would you suggest that they do start writing for other blogs or build their own platform or both? Or what would be the sort of starting out place?
Yeah, I would do both, because what Google really cares about is links coming into your site. That's kind of their sign of popularity. So if you're writing for someone else online, then that enables you to link back to your own site, which is going to help. And it also gets you practice in another arena. I think if you're starting out, the more practice you get, the better. And the more you write for other people in different styles, the better that's going to make you at doing freelance work in the future. Because the way we write for our own blogs is not the way we're going to write for a magazine. And that's not the way we're going to write for a different website that's going after a different audience. So you kind of have to be a chameleon when you're freelancing. And when it's your own blog, you want to do the opposite, really. You want to have a unique voice and be known for that. And so it's good to get as much experience as you can. And I always tell people when they're starting out, take every job you can get. You know, don't worry about what it pays. Because you need the clips, you need the experience, you need the links back. All of those things are sort of currency, actually.
And then the other thing I noticed with other travel writers is relationships with editors and, you know, people that they've built up relationships over time at these various blogs or magazines, so that they can pitch ideas. So is that kind of relationship building critical, especially if you want some of those magazine, you know, bigger magazines?
Yeah, it is. The problem is editors move on a lot. It's a revolving door. So that's very frustrating. But yeah, the one print magazine I still write for regularly is called Global Traveler. And it's mostly because they've had the same editor for years and years. And so I do have a relationship there, and I don't have to work so hard on, you know, convincing someone new that I can write a good piece for them. That's the most frustrating part about being a freelancer, is I think, is the constant querying, and it's not even rejection. It's more a matter of not getting an answer. You know, half the time you don't even get a response, or actually if you're getting half the time response, that's pretty good. So if you can have a relationship where you can pitch an idea and mull it over with them and come to an agreement on what's going to work, then that's a lot more fulfilling than just sending out blind pitches all the time. So yeah, meet editors whenever you can in person, go to conferences. If you get a job with an editor, do a fantastic job. You know, turn everything in early, turn it in exactly as they expected, exact word count that they wanted. Just do a fantastic job. If you make their life easier, you'll probably get hired again.
And that actually, it makes me think about a question around the actual writing itself, because travel writing, I guess, people think is about places like, oh, you get to go diving in the Philippines and write something about that. But is travel writing about a place really, or is it about people? Or what are some tips for writing travel pieces that actually resonate?
Well, there are a few different kinds, and most travel writers are, you know, bouncing around between the different types of writing. There's a lot of service writing. That's what really is in demand. So it's not about your trip. It's about helping other people plan their trip. So that's why you see so many of these top five beaches in the Philippines to get back to there, or, you know, the eight best Thai restaurants in New York City or whatever. You know, those listicle kind of things have always been in demand, even in the magazine days, and they'll probably be in demand 100 years from now. So there's just something in our brain that reacts to that organization being the organization of a list. So there's a lot of that. But then there's also narrative travel stories, which I think is what people think of a lot of times when they think of travel writing. Those more long form story kind of pieces, which are in a lot of ways more gratifying to write, but they're not as much in demand. I have a site called Perceptive Travel that's been around since 2006. And in an ideal world, it would be the most popular site on the internet, but it's all narrative travel stories, and it's not by any means. It's never going to be as popular as the ones running a bunch of listicles.
Yeah. So you mentioned three types and gave us two. Was there another type?
Oh yeah. Sorry. So, you know, I guess there is the whole memoir, and that's kind of the same as a narrative, but not exactly. It's more about discovery through travel, you know. But of course, there are just regular destination pieces, too, that are not necessarily narrative, but they're all about the place and not about the person. So we have some that focus all on the narrator and some that don't focus at all on the narrator. And it a lot of times just depends on the publication as to what they want. And I think a lot of blogs are naturally just first person focused on the person writing, because there's kind of a personality behind it, and the readers kind of get to know that person. Whereas on, you know, TV and in like AAA kind of magazines, it's usually about the place more than anything.
That is really interesting. And then I wanted to ask you about photos, because it seems like there would be two types of photos. One would be the photos that you take for your research. Like, I take photos when I travel that I then use when I write my pieces. But then if you're writing for, and obviously you could use on your blog, but professional photos for a magazine or something that you're being paid for, how does taking photos work with the travel writing, and do you license them in a different way?
Well, photos have really kind of gotten devalued over the years. I feel bad for the professional photographers, because they keep having to buy all this expensive equipment, but they're not getting paid as much for their work. And so it's kind of a drag. And it's just because that photos have become so ubiquitous. Everybody's got a camera in their pocket that takes pretty decent photos. And so, you know, it's that last 10% that you get with the really good camera and the really good lenses and the really good eye. So they're being paid for that last 10%. I rarely get paid for my photos. I do now and then, but a lot of magazines I write for, and online sites especially, it's just part of the contract. You have to supply photos, and it's not even really up for negotiation. They're just not going to pay for it. Whereas the higher up you get, the more professional the magazine, the bigger the circulation, the more likely they are to pay extra for it. And then, of course, a lot of photographers, pro or amateur, will sell their photos to stock services. And you don't make a lot of money. You might make 50 cents a photo or something. But if you sell enough of them, then that can add up to something. And then if you're a blogger, you pretty much have to have photos on your blog these days. And so it's just a requirement of being a travel writer, really. The cover of my book is actually related to that, Travel Writing 2.0. It's got this like Indian sort of goddess with six arms, because I think that's what it's really like these days. You have to be doing anything and everything. You're not just putting words on the screen. It's not about just that anymore.
Yeah, I think that's probably true for most of us. I feel like that as an indie writer, for sure. So just to circle back on intellectual property rights there, when you, like you said, you get a contract and it's not really up for negotiation because, you know, maybe they're too powerful in some way. But do you ever keep the rights to that article? So, for example, like with a short story, you could license it for first publication and then you could self-publish it later or use it on your blog later. So what are the types of, like, do you get your articles back again, basically?
Yeah, that's a tough one. A lot of it depends on the publication. Again, the higher up it is, the more likely you are to be able to haggle over those details. But it used to be, when I started out as a freelancer, you signed off first North American rights or something like that. But most of the contracts I see now are all rights. I mean, it's work for hire, or it's you still maybe can do what you want with it later, but they own the right to do anything they want with it on the web and in print, because they all have these print properties and online properties, the magazines do, and they want to be able to use this stuff in perpetuity without having to ask. And so some people get more worked up about this than I do. I just figure I'm going to rewrite it and do a different slant if I want to use it for something else. So I guess I consider my articles for pay, I just go in thinking they're going to be work for hire, I guess. If I ever was going to do a book around them or something, I would worry about it. But I don't know. I feel like if you're prolific enough, unless you're really writing some major 8,000 word feature that can become a movie later, I don't think the rights are all that big a deal. Not to me anyway.
So then I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned prolific, and you are prolific. Like, when I have a look at all the different sites that you have, and, you know, I wonder if you could talk about, how do you juggle writing articles, blogging, all your books? You have a family, you also have to travel. So how do you manage your time? And also, you wrote a really great guest post for The Creative Pen about immediate cash flow versus building for the long term, which again are two different types of writing. So can you talk about time management and those different time periods for income?
Yeah, I've done a lot of reading and experimenting on this subject, because I do run five different websites. It used to be six, and then I've got books out and other things. So I've kind of had to learn how to be productive, or I would be in trouble. And I actually run a course on this called Productivity Power for Writers, not just for travel writers, any writers, because I think the concepts are pretty universal. But two of the key things are automate what you can and outsource what you can. And I'm sure you do a good bit of both yourself. If you can systemize something and make it automatic, or, you know, if you can schedule your social media posts in advance and things like that, that will help. Automate what you can with if this, then that, and other, you know, things like that for social media. But then I also have a lot of help. I've got three different assistants that work on different aspects of my business. And I pay someone who sells advertising a commission, so I don't have to mess with that part. So, you know, I'm trying always to free up as much time as I can for what I think is my core competency, which is writing and running my sites, you know, creating content and making sure everything's working properly. And I would rather leave the drudgery stuff to someone else if I can.
Yeah. But what about your own traveling? I mean, you know, because you still are a travel writer, and obviously you still love traveling, but you have, you know, a family, and, you know, you're trying to do all this. So how do you fill your creative well and do everything else?
Well, I'm not nomadic for one thing. I've always had a base, except that for during that first bout of round the world travel. So I generally will go out and back. You know, I do a trip and then I come home and I write for a couple of weeks and then I go out again. Mm-hmm. So I'm generally doing an average of one a month, probably. So it is difficult when you travel, and that's why I could never do it full time and do this. Some people manage it, but they often get burned out after a while and end up getting a base of some kind, or they'll go do real slow travel where they'll go somewhere for a month and have an Airbnb, then they'll go somewhere for 2 months and have a place. That's a lot easier. So I think what you can do on the road is basically maintain. You can keep everything from falling apart. You can put out the fires. You can, you know, respond to emails, but it's hard to really get ahead and do, you know, deep work, creative work. And so I definitely need that time and my laptop in between. I did go off the grid for a whole week last year on a hiking trip, which was a real test because, you know, I just basically could not get online for a week. And I knew that ahead of time. So I set up a lot of things in advance. And I had my social media manager still sending out things for me. So I didn't have to worry about that part. It's tough, though.
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that, because I feel exactly the same. Like a lot of my fiction is written about my travels. But when I'm on my travels, I can't write. I need boring routine in order to do creative writing. So it really helps me to know that you do the same. Like, I was jealous of these people who are like, yay, I'm writing in a cafe in Thailand. And I'm like, nah, I'd just be out doing Thailand things.
Yeah. And, you know, back to that service writing thing, I think I could sit in a cafe in Thailand and bang out, you know, the five best coffee shops in Bangkok kind of article, because you don't have to think too hard about that. But if you're doing something that really requires concentration, you need, you know, an hour or two of nothing but, you know, with everything else turned off. And that's another difficult thing I think that people in their 20s especially have to come around to, is you really need to turn off all the distractions if you're going to write something that requires concentration. And they're used to having their phone buzzing constantly and notifications coming in, and that's really detrimental to doing good work, I think.
Doing that deep work, I guess, like Cal Newport. But then I also think, I wonder, you know, I'm 43, and I wonder if people who are, you know, two generations younger have a completely different brain. So maybe it's just us, Tim.
Yeah, I've read a lot of research on this, and the thing that comes out of it is people who think they're good at multitasking really aren't when you test them. Your brain can still only do one thing at a time. It's just a matter of how fast you are switching back and forth and how well you can handle that. But very hard to get back on task after you get distracted, no matter how young you are.
I agree. Now, you mentioned having a home base there, and in your book, A Better Life for Half the Price, you really talk about downsizing and moving to another country to cut living costs and also still have a good life. And I know, like, when I decided to become a full-time author, we sold our house, we did move countries, but it didn't quite fit your definition, because we moved Australia from Brisbane, Australia to London, one of the most expensive places in the world. But we did move from like a four bedroom house to a one bedroom flat. So we did some of the things that you talk about. But tell us about what you did, and also how you live now, and why you're moving back, and some of the pros and cons, you know, what's in people's heads when they consider that, because it's quite dramatic.
Well, when I was younger, I taught English. My wife and I both taught English in Turkey and Korea, and we really liked that experience of actually living somewhere as opposed to just, you know, passing through. And when our daughter was born, we had to stay put for a while, but then we kept talking about, you know, wouldn't it be nice to go live somewhere else for a while, just to give her that experience as well. And we settled on Mexico, partly because it's close and easy as far as getting back and forth, you know, on a plane. And I just sort of fell in love with the city the first time I went there, called Guanajuato in Mexico. It's an old colonial city, but it's up in the mountains. It's 6,500 feet, so like 2,000 meters. So the weather's really nice all year. It's one of those, you know, eternal spring kind of climates. And, you know, buildings from before there wasn't a USA, very old buildings. And that's always interesting. And And it's just, it's not a big city. It's kind of mellow. And so I like the pace and everything. So anyway, we moved there for a year. We came back to the U.S. for a while. And then we moved there for 2 years, the second time. And then this time we're going back with no end in sight. So we'll see what happens because my daughter's going off to college. And so my wife and I are going back there. But it's funny, the house is actually bigger than where we live now. But when we go down, all we can take is suitcases. Like it's too far to drive from Florida to the middle of Mexico. So we ended up buying a lot of things there as opposed to bringing them down, which is kind of fun anyway, especially in Mexico where there's such great handicrafts and, you know, cool Talavera pottery and all that stuff. But yeah, my job doesn't change at all. So that's one of the beautiful things about being a writer or any other kind of job where you have mobility is you, as long as you got your laptop and a good internet connection, you can work from anywhere. So that's kind of the point I'm making in that book. You know, there are jobs, physical jobs you can get in other countries, but the best is if you can keep earning in your home currency, but you can live in a cheaper country. And there's a lot of them out there, then you have so much more money to spend, you know, there's just so much, or you don't have to earn as much, you know, so maybe you can work less either way. So, I mean, it literally drops in half when we go from one country to our neighboring country and we're not very careful either. It drops in half with us going out more. So it's a nice, that's why I say a better life for half the price, just because, everything gets cheaper, including healthcare. That's a big one for Americans.
Yeah. And I'm obviously I've lived all over the place. So I get what you mean, but I know that some people have almost just an inclination not to ever do that. I mean, especially when there are, you know, things in the press that make some of these countries sound very violent or, you know, dangerous, or like some people think, oh, if somewhere is cheaper, then it must be worse. So, yeah, I mean, is that, I mean, obviously there are areas of any country that are horrible and dangerous. But is there anything that, you know, you would say to kind of soothe people's anxieties? Is it just a case of going visiting?
Yeah, that's part of it. And yeah, there's always that fear of the unknown. But I always tell Americans, watch your own evening news, you know, your local news, and tell me where you're living safe. You know, if somebody else from another country saw your nightly news, they would think, oh my God, what a hellhole, you know, because it's scary, you know, and there are cities in the U.S. that have a much higher murder rate than cities in Mexico. I mean, St. Louis, New Orleans, which nobody's scared to go to New Orleans, but they have a really high homicide rate, D.C., even our nation's capital. And so, you know, that's part of it. We've got way more guns here than anybody else. And so I don't think the U.S. is any safe, stable, even either. And even I was just in Canada a few weeks ago and July, and there were 10 murders in one night in Toronto, and they were kind of freaked out about it, you know, and Canada's generally seem to be safe, but there are problems everywhere, you know. And I would say there are places that are quite safe that are still very cheap, especially in Europe. I mean, the Balkan countries these days, Eastern Europe, like, you know, Romania, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, those places are relatively safe, and Portugal is quite a deal for living there. And, you know, they have a very low crime rate. So, you know, a lot of times people are just scared of what's different more than the actual safety problem. I mean, there is serious violence in Mexico, but it's generally not where gringos are living.
It's funny you say that, because I remember being in Jerusalem and I was talking about going to New York, and this, you know, Jerusalem native was like, "You're going to New York? That's so dangerous." And it, yeah, is, it just depends on what country you're in, doesn't it? Whereas so many people think going to Israel must be so dangerous because of all the press we get. So it is definitely. And I mean, even in London, there were, I don't know if you remember, there were riots in London a couple of years back. And we had a phone call, like they were literally round the corner from us, and we slept through the whole thing. You know, people phoning us going, "Are you okay?" And we're like, we didn't even know about it. So, I mean, it is all relative. Yeah.
And the good thing these days is you can find out from people on the ground very easily what's actually going on. You know, you can read local news, but also you can go on Facebook groups or expat message boards or whatever and see what the real situation is.
Yeah. And I mean, at the end of the day, people are people. That's, as writers, I think that's what we find out, isn't it? Like, people love their children. They're, you know, they love their country. They're generally nice to people. That people are nice. And then there's a percentage who are horrible the world over.
Yeah.
Last question, because I'm really interested. Again, your career has kind of spanned the older way of doing things, and now, of course, this new way of doing things in the new media landscape, as you call it. So, what have you found right now as to be the most effective way of marketing yourself as a writer, and you know, kind of just marketing ways to sell your books and your writing?
Well, the important thing is to build up a platform of some kind, and whether that's a blog or a podcast or whatever it may be, you need to build up a tribe of followers or people that are interested in that specific subject. So, you know, if you're blogging about Atlanta, for instance, and you become known as the expert on Atlanta, then that is going to bring in all kinds of other opportunities for freelance work, for books, for tours or whatever. But it all starts with having an audience. So if you don't have any kind of platform, a book publisher or an agent is not going to be interested in you. If you self-publish something, nobody's going to buy it. You know, you've got to have an audience in order to launch all these other things. And so find something that you care about enough to write about it every week for years on end, and you'll probably be off to a good start. So even if you're only a freelancer, it still can help if you have some kind of specialty that you're known for. So if you're a person who writes about skiing all the time, you're going to have a lot easier time placing articles than if you write about something different every single week and you're just kind of a jack of all trades.
Do you find, I'm interested in your strategy around guest posting, because a lot of people, you know, used to say, oh, guest posting is the way to get traffic to your website. And then a lot of people have stopped guest posting because, I don't know why, it went out of trend. But do you still find guest posting a really good strategy?
Yeah, I do. And I don't go crazy with it. I think that's what people did wrong. They would do 50 of them in the same week. And then maybe that sends a flag to Google that it's a little suspicious. I don't know. But I just do them here and there where it makes sense for sites that are aligned well with what I'm doing, like yours. So I do think it's a good way. Not just, people got into doing it just for SEO purposes, you know, just to have a high domain link back to their site, as they say, a high, you know, high Moz rank or whatever. But I think it's important just to reach a new audience, to reach new potential readers and new potential book buyers or followers or whatever. And there's only so much you can do through social media and even email marketing. You're only reaching the people who already know about you. So if you can guest post, you can reach some other people. And I did one on Tim Ferriss's blog maybe 8 or 9 years ago when he wasn't so famous as he is now. And I'm still getting traffic from it, you know, like 9 years later. So, I mean, I've gotten tens of thousands of people who have come over from there to my blog. So that's worth a lot.
Yeah, that is really interesting, because I was having a look at all the places you guest blogged and I was like, oh, wow, you know, that's amazing. So do you have, and I think that's the problem people have, is who to target. So how do you find the best places to guest post?
Well, start with the ones that you already follow or like. I mean, that's a good place. If there's somebody's podcast you listen to already and it's related to your niche or, you know, your interest, then that's a good place to start. You can always just go searching around, or the 2 degrees of separation thing. You know, who does that person follow, or who do they link to? And that way you can discover new ones. But again, the more narrow your niche is, the easier it is to find one. I mean, even writing is pretty narrow, I think, on its own, as far as how many good blogs and podcasts are out there. But if you write about skiing or hang gliding or, you know, kite surfing or whatever, there's probably only a few of them out there you need to be on. And so go target those.
No, you're right. It's just about doing that research. Well, this has been super interesting. Tell people where they can find you and everything you do online.
Sure. Well, the Cheapest Destinations blog is where it's only me writing. And so that's the one site where it's just my work all the time. But my portfolio site is just my name, timleffel.com. And that links out to everything. It links to the books, to the sites I run, to some freelance articles I've written and that kind of thing. So if you can remember my name, that's the easiest way to find me. And then my social media links are on there, which are usually my name, but sometimes not. Because like my name was taken on Instagram, so I got something else. But anyway, just so, search my name.
And so many of us have that on Instagram.
There's a lot of Tim Luffles out there.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Tim. That was great.
Well, thanks for having me. And I got to say, I really like listening to your podcast because I've been on someone sometimes where I feel self-conscious because I'm laughing and you laugh at the absurdity of everything like I do. And I like that.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Tim Leffel today and that it gave you an interesting perspective on how to think about your writing in terms of now, soon and future income, which will mainly be from intellectual property rights. So definitely make sure you're creating for the long term as well as immediate cash. So next week, I have a great interview on the author mindset, choose wonder over worry with Amber Ray. And we have a great chat about self-doubt and anxiety and how to get over those things and create from the heart. And it's a really fun interview and as ever, lots of honesty. So happy writing week and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.